Hello, you're listening to Shut Up and Watch This, episode number 67. I'm Dave.
I'm Ashley.
We're a couple in Austin, Texas, getting to know each other better by uncovering each other's movie and pop culture blind spots and sharing our must-see movies and guilty pleasures.
From the past.
From the past. I'm off script. This is what I remember. I'm off book. That's what it's called.
Yes.
Each week. One of us is in command of the choosing. Once the choosing occurs,
it's like Russell Crowe or something. I've not seen that movie.
I'm going for dystopian podcast.
That's right.
Once the choosing occurs, a viewing ensues.
A viewing ensues.
Okay, let's get down to it. Each week, one of us gets to choose the show or the movie that we watch, and then we watch it together and dissect it for you guys. Well, course, for each other, we're having a conversation.
Yes, that's right.
It was my turn.
You chose this time, Dave. Dave, what did you choose?
I chose the 2006 indie movie Old Joy.
Old Joy.
By director Kelly Reichardt. Starring, what's his name? Daniel London.
Dudley.
And Will Oldham.
I'm not it's familiar sort of with either of those actors, so it was like...
So here's my challenge to you.
Yes.
I think this might be the one time we can do a synopsis of the movie in one sentence.
Oh, yeah.
Can you do that? Are you up to the task?
Two old friends go on a road trip to a spring in Oregon, to a hot springs in Oregon.
And scene.
That's it. That's all that happens.
That's the movie, and this is our shortest episode.
So, interesting. This movie was so understated that I was like, maybe I should do some research on this, because I don't know anything about the actors. I don't know much about the... And then I thought, well, you know what? Let's just approach this the same way the movie felt like it was approached. Just like kind of as like stripped down to just like, I don't know. It's just such a hands-off kind of, I don't know if I'm describing this well, but anyway,
what I'm picking up on is minimalist.
Minimal. Yes. That's it. Yes.
Space.
Yeah.
A room to approach it.
Yeah, it was.
Maybe something about you make of it what you bring to it. Too.
Exactly.
There's something there
so.
About that.
Yeah. So I had never seen this movie. I hadn't even heard of this movie before.
It's Kelly Reichardt's first film.
Yeah.
And I didn't hear about it until about a year after it came out when I was working in my first library job. Mm-hmm. In Spokane, Washington, and I had a coworker who used to always talk about movies with. We'd like shop talk on Monday mornings. She'd come back and tell me everything she rented, and she raved about this movie. And then it was some time before I got a chance to actually catch up with it.
Well, because if it was 2006, that's when your youngest was born, I believe. So,
yeah, so
busy time.
I probably caught up. I don't think I like rushed out and like. Rented it. This would have been Netflix disc mail days.
Oh, yes.
Right? It's pre-streaming.
How long did it sit on top of your DVD player?
No, I watched it right away. I just didn't order it right away.
Okay.
It was probably about 2 years before I actually got around to seeing it, because I didn't really watch any movies
during
that time.
It's not like Vera Drake, which sat on there and we never watched. That was like the last batch.
I can go one better on that. I have a copy of Vera Drake on DVD that I got as a gift that I still haven't
still
watched.
Still haven't watched, yeah.
I think I saw the first hour and then, but I, it was, never mind, going
well,
off topic.
Speaking of, yeah. I mean, like, the reason that I haven't seen a lot of Kelly Reichardt is because, I mean, like, my first knowledge of her was for the movie Wendy and Lucy, which I've not seen. But I heard a description of the movie, and I was like, I never want to see that movie, because that's the kind of movie where I'll cry, like, ugly cry throughout the whole thing, and probably would end up really depressed at the end, about a girl who loses her dog. So
okay,
that was my kind of sole experience, other than I did watch Meek's Cut Off at your suggestion, like, in the year before we started dating. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Those are her first three films.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Her follow-up to this movie was Wendy and Lucy. And that's... I actually still haven't seen Wendy and Lucy. That's
not, I can't.
It's had a bad habit of seeing, like... Especially when my kids were younger, I would start movies that I would never have the opportunity to finish. And yeah. Wendy and Lucy was one of those.
I can't... I mean, like, I don't think it ends well. She's looking for her lost dog. It doesn't seem... That's the kind of thing that would just break me. I just don't.
I just assumed that you had seen it. I don't remember if I've ever asked about it. But I know you love Michelle Williams. Thought you would have seen and loved that movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. And now it doesn't sound like I can even convince you to still...
I can be convinced to see it just from the description. It just seems like the kind of movie that would depress
okay,
me
beyond... Okay, but Lucy's okay in real life. Lucy is Kelly Reichardt's actual dog, which I learned <She's fine. laughs> that Lucy is Kelly Reichardt's dog.
So Lucy is in this movie as well.
Yeah, also named it's Lucy. Not just two friends, it's three friends on three a road friends, trip.
That's right. Lucy is there the whole time.
So, should I talk about why I chose this?
Yes, yeah, talk about that.
So, interestingly, like, I have a whole process whenever it's my turn.
Yeah.
A messy process when it's my turn to choose. I usually have so many movies that I eventually want to show that it's usually a question of which is the right one for this week. And so, we're not wine drinkers, but for me, it's kind of like pairing the right wine to a meal.
Mm.
Only... what I'm trying to do is impossible. It's like, what movie matches the current disaster of our country and everything falling apart all around us? So that's sort of where we were as it was my...
Pinot Grigio!
Yeah, right? That's sort of where we were as it's my turn to pick a movie. And so I was thinking about all of these things on my short list and I was kind of making a new list of stuff I hadn't gotten to yet. And all of them were like... typical Dave, like dark, pessimistic character studies, alienation, or else they're like impenetrable, more like foreign films, or else in some cases there were movies about fascism. And I was like, let's not do that right now. Let's hold on The Conformist for another couple months, maybe. So what I realized is like we had a hard week last week, and so I almost was just going to give up. We're a week late getting this out as it is, I think. But so I finally came around to screw all that. What we really need, like, what can I find that's, like, really calm?
Yeah.
And so, and then there are shades of that, right? Then I had a short list of light movies, you know, light comedy kind of thing. I never have very many of those for some reason. I don't know. But...
how to bring the levity.
I finally just came around to what could possibly be the harm of getting into this car with these two guys and doing this really quiet, understated character study of these two friends trying to reconnect, not necessarily successfully, but at least I knew there's not a lot of overt conflict in this movie.
Yeah.
And you can really just sit there and kind of look out the window with them and go to the campsite. And it's quiet. It's conversation. It's thoughtful. It's meditative. It's got this musical score by Yola Tengo. So that's how I got to this. It was a last second, like, this is what we're going to watch right now. I'm pressing play. Whereas 3 minutes before, I had three other movies in my head.
Yeah.
That was exhausting. Do you see how exhausting it is to be me and to have to choose the movie?
So my process is not nearly that fraught, I suppose.
You're probably like, God damn it, what can I possibly...
I was like, what have you seen? What do you... You know, what am I in the mood for? I guess I'm more interested in what I'm in the mood for, I guess, than...
I know that you've... I don't know. I suddenly became self-conscious, too. I was like, there's so many great... women filmmakers that we haven't gotten a chance to deal with on our show yet. Yeah. And so I know we've done some Sofia Coppola before.
Yeah.
And maybe one or two others, but I was like, there's like four or five directors that I have really favorite films of that I'd like to get into. And this just seemed like the right one. So that was another part of it too.
Yeah.
I was like, we've never talked about Kelly Reichardt. I really like those first, well, I still haven't seen all of Wendy and Lucy. I like two of them a lot.
Well, I mean, I think that's a great impulse, you know, because unless we, you know, actively seek out, you know, films made by women and by people from diverse backgrounds. Like, it's really easy just to see movies made by men, you know, so I think that it's, and like, luckily we have Criterion, so we can, like, they have all these great, like, curated things. We watched lots of Agnes Varda this year, and, you know, so we are sort of branching out and seeing more, and they actually have, like, a great, like, queer cinema series that we mm-hmm. watched a bunch from, and the Black directors, we watched a bunch of those this year, so... But I do think it's cool to be, like, conscious of that and making sure that we're seeing, you know, women and making sure that the podcast represents, you know, all sorts of directors. So, yay.
So I wanted to start a new year with that,
too. Yeah.
And then I was intrigued because I've only seen this film once. The details of it didn't stay with me. What stayed with me was the mood, which felt safe and calm and like something to just be with.
Yeah.
And that's most of all probably what I needed, you know. And then here, on the other hand, I was so excited about getting my giant Fellini Criterion box set, right? Yeah. I waited, like, whining about it. I waited
for
it
to come for something.
2 weeks. I waited for it in the mail.
Don't order things media mail.
And none of those felt right. And in any case, we had just done 8.5 about a year ago. I mean, it hasn't even been that long. So it wasn't right. It wasn't right. And then I was intrigued, like, this is Kelly Reichardt. This is her first film. Why did she make a movie about two guys hanging out? What's her entry point here? And what is she getting at?
Well, I don't know the answer to that because I didn't do any research. From my context clues, it's like dedicated to two guys. Like the film, it's dedicated to like Andy and Allie or something like
well,
that.
Well, it is from a short story that I've never read. Yeah. I mean, I don't know if the story has the same title. It might, because it just says from a short story by Jonathan Raymond. Actually, I don't even know if it's a published short story. It just says from a short story by Jonathan Raymond.
Yeah.
So I didn't have a chance to look it up and go back to the source material. So it comes from something, and it really does feel like a short story.
Yeah. Yeah, it does.
Although...
But, like, I mean... Yeah, and I've read a lot of short fiction, and they're definitely... I wonder... Now I kind of wonder, like, when it came out. But it doesn't matter, because...
it's 2006.
Yeah, it just... it to me, like... I'm always intrigued by the idea of, like, what if you tell a story where, like, nothing happens? Or, like, people are just living their life. And, like, I know you can't do that really, but this is pretty close to that as you can get, you know, people having phone calls, people making plans, people stopping at, you know,
convenience stores,
people getting lost. Gas. Yeah. In Oregon, you know, so it's pretty.
Okay. Here's an interesting counterpoint. Yeah. We have the same scene in two different movies that we just watched. We just watched, Wong Kar Wai's Happy Together last night, which also opens with them on the road getting lost with the map and having to stop. Only for them, that's a hugely volatile, awful moment that turns into an epic argument, and then they end up kind of splitting up again. Yeah. That does not happen in this. It's literally just like they got turned around. It's not. There's no external conflict in this. Yeah. It's all, if anything, there's internal conflict. And so there's not very many movies that just do internal conflict.
Yeah.
And you can't even get, I'd be curious to go back to the short story, because in prose, you can give the interiority of the character, like you can do their interior monologue. We don't know what they're thinking, except what we see from how their body language and how they relate to each other and what they say.
Yeah, how they say it.
So maybe we should break down who these two different guys are.
Okay.
So... Mark is the one who's married.
Yeah, so Mark is married. His wife is like 7 or 8 months pregnant. She's pretty... She's approaching the end of her pregnancy, so she's probably a month out or something like that. And what's the other guy's name?
Kurt.
Kurt gives him a call and's like, hey, you want to take a weekend trip out to this hot springs in the middle of Oregon somewhere?
Bagby Hot Springs.
Bagby
Hot Springs. East of Portland.
It's a real place. It's not an imaginary place. Somewhere in the Cascade Mountains. Yeah. And so they go, and it's about them trying to get to the... They initially get lost and have to camp in a weird place overnight.
Okay. But who are they? They're pretty different, right?
Yeah. Mark is, you know, responsible... I mean, I never figured out what he does, but he has some sort of job. They have a place in Portland, I guess. And, I mean, we don't know a whole lot about Kurt other than what he says. He seems to travel around a lot. He smokes all the time. Like he's constantly high throughout the whole film, I think. I think there's a scene where they actually stop and he picks up some...
So, I don't... I mean, not to be disparaging or anything, yeah, but he's kind of like a hipster, hippie...
Yeah, he goes to, like, Burning Man
drifter
or something.
Kind.
Yeah.
He never mentions Burning Man, but...
It seems like
he
Burning.
Just seems to be kind of...
It's in Big Sur, though, so... Or
living hand-to-mouth.
Yeah.
He lives out... Does he live in that van that we see in the beginning?
So, the implication to me is that he lived in that house at one point. That he lived in the house that Mark is waiting on the porch.
Okay.
My feeling is that he, at one point, lived there. But I was going to ask, do you think he's homeless? Because to me, especially at the end, it seemed like he was homeless.
Well, I wanted to ask about that, too.
Yeah.
I don't know what to make of it. But here, so let's talk about the first time we see him and the last time we see him.
Yeah.
When, so, first of all, he does not plan ahead. Right?
No.
The movie starts because Mark is at home and gets a phone call from Kurt, who's literally like, dude, do you want to go camping tonight? We don't even hear his side of the conversation, but it's like, hey,
it's kind of short notice.
I'm here. And then you have an interesting scene where Mark, like, has to run it by his pregnant wife, and she's super irritated about, like, you're just going to go anyway. Don't make me feel like I have to give you permission.
Yeah.
And you know she doesn't want him to go.
Yeah.
And he knows she doesn't want him to go. And he's being courteous, giving the courtesy of asking, like, running it by her. What does running it by someone even mean? I'm making you aware of this. Should you have objections, then I totally won't go. He doesn't say that.
No.
So anyway, whatever, he goes.
Yeah.
And he goes to pick up Kurt. And so he's waiting outside the building you're talking
about.
The
implication was that Kurt was going to drive, but then he ends up not driving.
But when Kurt shows, when he's at the meeting point, Kurt comes schlepping up with, like, a rucksack, like a backpack, and, like, a portable TV.
In a wagon. Like, in an old red wagon.
In a Radio Flyer red wagon. Did he just get kicked out of some place he was staying? What's with the TV and the red wagon? I mean, it was very random.
Well, I mean, so when he arrives at the... It's the blue and yellow house. He knocks on the door and no one answers. And then Kurt comes from across the street after Mark's been there long enough that he's just sitting on the porch.
I feel like you may be onto something, that he doesn't live in that place anymore. But that's the address that they...
Well, and then later in the car, Mark asks him about whether they've sold the house or not. So, to me, it suggests that the house was either taken from them because of non-payment of taxes or something like that. Or, for some reason, they don't have the... So, he's just parked his van.
Well, and when he opens up his van, it looks like it's got all of his worldly possessions in there. To me, it looks like he might be living out of his van or something.
Yeah, that's what I think, too.
And then at the end of the film, we're jumping way ahead, the camping, I mean, they go camping. They eventually find the hot springs. They come back to town. That's like the arc of the movie.
Yeah.
The external, like the action. And then they have that weird scene where he's like kind of shuffling around outside the convenience store.
Yeah.
To see if it's open to go in and get something.
Yeah.
And a guy asks him for change.
Yeah.
And he says, sorry, I can't, buddy. You know, sorry. And then, like, he changes his mind. Doesn't go into the store, right? And then gives the guy money.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's, like, he just gave the guy his last.
I don't know. It's.
But it definitely, I don't know. You definitely feel like he's lost. Or, like, I don't know. I think you might be right. But it doesn't, but we don't know.
Yeah.
And that's not what it's about.
No.
But they really don't have very much in common.
No.
I mean, I guess did they go to college together? Were they roommates or something?
Yeah, I think they went to college together because they talked about some of their old friends from college a little bit. But yeah, I don't think Kurt is ever honest with Mark about what's really going on with him, you know, which may be the sort of barrier that we're sensing there is that maybe Kurt doesn't feel comfortable discussing his situation with Mark, who's, you know, having a kid and settled down. And
I think Mark isn't comfortable asking overtly about Kurt's situation because he probably is picking up on there isn't much of a situation.
Yeah.
Like, it's obvious that Kurt is kind of drifting from one thing to another. Like, the stories he does tell about what he's been up to is, you know, going out to Big Sur and running into somebody and going camping and smoking pot with somebody else and talking about the old days. And, you know, he doesn't have a stable job.
Yeah.
We suspect he doesn't have a stable living situation. He seems like maybe somebody who kind of drives around couch surfing or smoking pot, couch surfing, and also he has kind of a vibe of maybe being interested in spirituality a little bit and kind of like you could picture. Interestingly, it's Mark who's meditating in the opening scene.
Oh, that's right.
In the garden before the phone call comes. And so that's almost like you see a glimpse of, I don't know, maybe they used to both be kind of hippie types. But Mark has a job and a baby on the way and a wife and a stable situation. And it's just kind of like, they are not in the same place anymore.
I kind of wonder why Mark wanted to go.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, we don't get a sense that, it didn't seem like Mark had all that much fun. I don't know.
Well, maybe he's
just not very expressive kind of guy, but I was like,
I thought maybe for him, like, he seems genuinely excited to hear from him.
Yeah.
Like, he thinks it's going to be fun. So I feel like part of it is that this doesn't live up to either of their expectations.
Yeah.
I think Kurt thinks they're going to super, like, bond or something like that. And Mark, maybe it's a nostalgia thing. Like, they were close or they were buddies. And he's about to be super locked down, right?
Yeah.
It's almost like hanging out with Kurt is seeing the other path.
Yeah. That's true.
And then when Kurt sees him, it's like him seeing the other path, too.
So I kind of, because I've never been in this situation, I kind of, like, wonder what it's like to be, like, expecting a major change in your life, like having a kid. Because that's not something that I've experienced, you know, like, you have this whole period where it's, like, growing, and, like, you know your life is going to change, but you don't know what it's going to look like, and, like, you hear all these things of how it's going to be, but you can't really have any kind of idea. Is it, like, coming up to a cliff that you don't know what's happening,
have a very brief conversation about that.
Yeah.
Because Kurt sometimes asks, while they're hiking or on the road together, Kurt sometimes asks about things like, so are you excited about being a dad? Like, is that cool? Or, you know, and he's like, yeah, we're super busy and, like, have no time on our hands. Like, work is crazy right now, but, you know, we'll make it happen. It's going to be different. We don't really know what it's going to be. All of what you just said, they have a brief exchange about.
It just seems like such a big, like, and there's no way you can prepare for it. You can read all the books and everything, but I don't know, going from not having that to having that, it's, I don't know, it seems like it would be impossible. So maybe that's what's going on a little bit in Mark's mind, is that he's, I don't know, a little apprehensive of that, and I don't know, wanted to take some time to reflect.
It's like a bachelor party getaway or something. It's like a chance to live a different life, like Kurt's life, for a couple of days, but I don't think he really likes Kurt's life.
Yeah.
So tell me about how the trip actually goes. Like, it's not that great.
No, so the first night, I guess they're supposed to get there the first night.
I think they're supposed to stay overnight at the Springs.
Yeah, but they get turned around, and like, this is one of those things where I didn't know when the film was made, or what time period it was supposed to be in, because cell phones are not prominent in it. There is a cell phone in it, but it's like a old school one. So
this is 2006.
Yeah.
The first iPhone has not come out yet.
Yeah.
So this is a pre-smartphone era movie. So that's something to take into consideration.
So, but like they get lost, which actually it reminds me, this still happens. Like, I don't remember, 3 or 4 years ago, we went on a road trip to Archer City.
Where you lose your connection.
Yeah, there's no connection in the middle of Texas. And so like we had to stop at a convenience store and buy a map. And try to figure out where we were and how to get back to...
Which is so weird.
Yeah.
When's the last time you've had to do that?
Like, I kept driving hoping that we would eventually get reception, and I didn't know what direction we were going in. So we finally, like, we went back to Archer City and got a map at the...
When I went to college in the early 90s, I had one of those giant Thomas Guide books, right, of maps for San Diego, and I had the LA one, too. Yeah. You used to have paper maps.
Yeah.
You used to have giant map books. Like, always in the car.
But, yeah, so they get lost on a road where, like, the closest mile marker is, like, so old that there's nothing written on it. It's blank or something like that. There's nothing on the sign. So they, you know, I think they were trying to go by feel, by the way that Kurt felt. And they kept, like, turning around and slowing down and... It starts to get dark, and they just find a weird pull-off somewhere where somebody has dumped off, like, a bunch of it looks like a dump site or something like that, and they end up camping in a dump site overnight. Well,
because I think they literally, the road is blocked,
yeah.
And it just, the little road in the woods, in the middle of in the dark, it's pitch dark, just ends at a place where somebody dumped their old furniture.
Yeah.
Which is super depressing. They stay at this shitty old ratty couch and trash and stuff around on the ground, and like, what other weird bits of furniture are there?
Yeah.
But it's like somebody's weird homeless squat in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
That's where they ended up camping.
It's lovely.
And so they have that evening of talking and shooting their little air gun.
Yeah.
At beer cans. And bonding.
Yeah.
I'm doing air quotes, which you guys can't see. I think that almost immediately, Mark kind of, I don't know. This is where I'm not sure where I'm projecting that I start to get irritated with Kurt pretty early on.
Yeah.
Because it's one of those things where he's like, I totally know exactly where it is. No, it's cool. We're there. I know where it is. Of course I do. But... then you realize he doesn't know what he's talking about or have any idea where it's going on, but he's so stoned that it doesn't really bug him. And Mark doesn't ever lose his temper. It's not really a point of conflict other than you can sense that this isn't really going
Mark's
very well.
Mark's kind of irritated,
It's not really that fun.
Yeah. That's... I did think it was kind of neat that Lucy got to sleep on the couch, though.
Oh, she didn't sleep in the
no, she was
tent?
Well, when they're at the fire thing, she's like, Kurt's sitting on the sofa and Lucy's on the couch next to him. I can't remember much what they talked about during that time. I think that was when the fatherhood thing came up.
I do remember one funny thing that struck me was... Kurt started going off when they got to that junk heap, and that's where they ended up. He kind of has this little riff on how it doesn't really matter because city and nature are kind of the same now,
right,
anyway. Because
the
junk from the city is making it out to nature, and nature's encroaching on the city. It's kind of really just the same thing now, if you think about it. It doesn't really matter if we're there or
here. That was your city.
And I was like, really? I think Mark was probably like, really?
So, and then they get up in the morning and end up going to a diner where they're able to ask for directions. And I think they're only like 10 miles from the place, ultimately, once they reach the...
Yeah.
The diner.
Another conversation that struck me was... And if... if there are some emotional beats of internal conflict or interpersonal conflict or something. Another one was, I think, that second day when they're on their approach, maybe they're hiking already. I think they're hiking on the last stretch to the to where the springs are or something. I can't remember which day it is. But Mark, I think, is explaining some volunteer project that he was involved in, that, you know, it's just one day a week, but I've been working with kids and we developed this community garden or something. Do you remember this?
Yeah, yeah.
And then Kurt is like, wow, that's really cool. I mean, Kurt is always so chill and so calm and really so positive most of the time. Like, you can sense that kind of gentle, benign presence. And he's like, that's really cool that you did that, you know, that you gave something back, you really made something. And Mark's kind of like, it was just a couple of hours a week, it's not that big a deal.
Yeah.
But he's like, no, man, I'm proud of you. And then Mark says something like, well, you know, it's not that hard to do something like that. You could always do something like that too. Like, it's not that hard to, like, do something for people. And then it gets really awkward.
Yeah.
Because it sounds like what we're hearing is like, you don't think he's doing anything with his life. The subtext there is like, you probably feel bad about the fact that you are making no contribution to society. You have no responsibilities. You're not doing anything for anybody. And it's not really that hard to do something for somebody or to have responsibilities. So then he makes it worse by dialing it back. It's like, not that I think you should have to do anything like that. So you just have moments like that where you realize what different places and what different lives they're leading at this point. And it's hard to see who they might have been when they were, like, I think, best friends.
Yeah.
That's what I'm not sure. Were they best friends?
I don't know. I think they might have just been in the same friend group.
Maybe they were roommates in a house of four people or something.
I don't know. There's always people that you hang on to, and then there's people that, I don't know, your lives get so different that you can't relate on the same level anymore, you know?
I think this story is about the moment they realize that they don't relate to each other anymore.
Yeah.
And that they might not see each other again after this.
Yeah.
I feel like, and that's the thing that I think it's easy to connect with, is that you have this in life. You've had this probably with friends in your life where you see them again after 5 years or 10 years. Some people you still have that connection with, and some people you realize, like, I'm glad we had what we had, but we don't really have that now. I don't have anything in common with you at all anymore.
Yeah.
So,
well, yeah, there's some things people are brought together by situation, and some people are brought together by a genuine likeness of spirit, and you know, it's sometimes it's hard to know, especially like in such an emotional time like college, you know, you know, which one is which one is just because we're together in the same space at the same time, and which one is because we actually have a communion of more than just situation and liking to drink beer together sometimes.
So we've been building up, they've been building up, that this is a trip to get to these hot springs, right? You at least have this destination. And it feels like, you almost feel like it's going to be one of those movies where they never get to the place.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, where it's this wonderful thing that they're never going to get to. Well, they get to it. And we spend a little time there. You want to explain, describe that a little bit?
I like that scene a lot. It's not very, I mean, I can't imagine being very comfortable if I were Mark or Kurt in that. It seemed kind of, I mean, it's, I don't know, there's this silence that overtakes, which I really like, because you can hear the water, and you can hear the trees and the birds, and I really liked that audioscape going on, but I think, like, when you think about the characters, that it was probably kind of a really uncomfortable silence, you know? And then there's that weird part where, like, Kurt, like, after I don't know, this interesting spring that I've never seen before.
Can you paint the setting for us? Like, what kind of, it's not like an open spring, like in...
No, so it looks like it's an old, it's old timber, bathhouse, but I don't know if it used to be built up better or if this was just, it was always built up to be this rustic, but it's a really rustic looking.
Nobody else is there. Just, it's just this bathhouse in the woods over the hot springs. Yeah,
and there's wooden tubs that I guess the hot springs feed into, but then you have to go get a bucket of cooler water, I think, or hot water.
I wasn't sure, but they had to put some buckets in.
They have to put buckets of water into their tubs, which I don't think filled up the whole thing, but I think maybe adjusted the temperature so that it was comfortable to sit in the water. So, you know, at first they're both in the tubs together, and then Kurt gets out and smokes some. And then, like, he walks over to Mark and tries to give him a shoulder rub. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, that to me was the most uncomfortable part, because Mark obviously does not want his shoulders rubbed initially, and then, like, he kind of, like, puts up with it.
Let's talk about that. I think this is, it's hugely significant. I mean, it's like this really strange moment.
Yeah.
What is going on?
I don't know, but, like,
so
they haven't really touched the whole movie, like, at all. They're not,
like, bro touchy buddies at all. And Mark is, like, you know, lying there in his hot tub. Like,
naked.
Naked. You know, with his head back against the wood, eyes closed some of the time or whatever. And Kurt has gotten out, put his shorts back on, smoked out a little bit. And this all plays out in pretty real time. It's a 10 or 15, it feels like a 10 to 15 minute sequence from the arrival. Because it is, there's not a lot of conversation. You see the ritual of the pouring the buckets and getting in there. And it's very relaxing. And then Kurt comes over. And comes up behind him. And starts massaging his shoulders. And Mark, like, flinches. I mean, like, it's, and you know, it's like, what are you, but he doesn't say anything, really.
Yeah.
Or does he say, I don't know if I can, or.
No, I don't think he ever said anything. He just kind of,
I think flinched. Kurt says something like,
and you seem like you need, relax, yeah.
Just relax, you need this. And then, it's really awkward, and it's really uncomfortable for Mark and for us as the viewer,
because
I don't know how to read that. I remember worrying about what was going to happen next. If Kurt was going to come onto him in some way. Yeah. Or something. Like, what? It's just this moment of, like, strangely discordant, out of place intimacy. And it's physical intimacy.
Yeah.
That they don't have. They're not, they don't even understand each other. And they don't have a touchy relationship. And that's not even a bro kind of touchiness.
No.
So there's some kind of, there's a feeling of, like, a taboo broken or something. And Mark wills him, you can see on his face, he will, because the camera just holds on his face the whole time with the hands kneading his shoulders. And it's kind of a long moment.
Yeah.
And he wills himself to close his eyes and to lower the shoulders and to lean back and relax into it. And then it still goes on for a while. We're still watching it for another good 20 seconds or so. And then it fades out and they're driving back. What is this about?
It was super awkward to watch. I think that that's, like, a physical demonstration of how the relationship has deteriorated. So, you know, maybe at one point they were at a point where there was hugging and hand slapping and, you know, all of that sort of thing.
I just wondered if maybe Kurt, in feeling like they're not really connecting and really desperately needing something, like, tries to force this as, like, one last desperate plea for connection of some kind. Because it feels like Kurt is the one who needs something. To me, it feels like Kurt needs something from Mark.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's something I'm bringing to the movie.
Well, when I think about, because I'm female and not party to many spaces that are exclusively male, so I don't, but I have been in situations with guys who, when they get extremely inebriated, sort of start breaking down those sort of socially set rules about touching each other and being friendly in a way that is more common amongst females, you know? So I don't know, maybe it had something to do with the fact that that Kurt was high at the time as well, and so his boundary feelers were not as strong as they might have been, you know. I mean, like, you know, when you think about the fact that, I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of sort of social constructs at play when men get together, especially, well, in the Western world, there's these expectations about, well, actually, all the whole world, about how men behave and how men behave with other men, and so...
So here's something, here's another thought. It seems so nakedly vulnerable for Kurt to do that.
Yeah.
Not knowing what the reaction to it would be.
Yeah.
And again, you have, like, yes, he's high. He has maybe questionable boundaries anyway. I mean, I don't know that he really, like, what he picks up on.
Yeah.
But I just feel like it says something about him needing something.
Yeah.
And feeling like maybe, maybe it's him feeling like this didn't go the way it was supposed to. We don't really connect the way we used to or the way I thought we would. It just seems like some kind of weird, impulsive, last desperate kind of attempt to reach Mark.
Yeah. Well, and I think, I mean, like, to go beyond sort of gender constructs, I guess, you know, when you talk about people and like, the way intimacy progresses, you know, that it starts with hands and then moves inward. And, like, your shoulders is, like, a really interior... I mean, it's not an interior part of your body, but it's closer to the core of things, you know? So, like, when you're getting friendly with a person for the first time, you shake their hand, and then, you know, like, I don't know, it seems like that sort of... And the sort of prolonged shoulder rub thing is... I mean, like, it doesn't matter what the gender identification of the person that you're touching, coming up to someone and rubbing their shoulders is like a level of intimacy that most people are not comfortable with. I mean, like, it would be really weird if one of my friends just randomly started doing that, you know. I don't have many friends that I do have that kind of relationship with, you know.
To me, it reads like the peak of the movie.
Yeah.
That moment is kind of like, and then it's falling action after that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like the conflict or the crisis is this kind of weird interior / physically intimate moment that we don't even know how to read.
Yeah.
And then the movie kind of just, the rest of the movie is just the return.
Yeah.
There's not much to it. I don't think it lasts much longer.
I don't think there are many conversations on the way back, it doesn't sound like. Like, we heard them talking the whole way there, but, like, on the trip back, it's, I think the radio comes back in and, you know.
On the other hand, because of the way this movie is so minimal, like, I know if there are viewers out there, I mean, people out there who haven't seen the film before, that it sounds like they talk a lot, but they don't talk a lot. This is not like My Dinner with Andre or something like that. We're describing conversations they're having, because there's not a lot to describe.
That's true. Yeah.
But they're, if you want to talk about the form of the actual movie, there's a lot of them just driving in the car in silence.
That's true.
With the soundtrack or with the sound of the highway. Or the really minimal, the music,
looking the guitar, the bass. Well, the camera looks out the window, you know, so we assume that somebody's looking out the window during all of that.
So it has a lot of ambient sound of the road trip, and it has the soundtrack music, the Yolo Tango music. And then it has these sporadic conversations, but it's like not wall-to-wall talking.
Yeah, yeah. It's pretty sparse. As you know, it reminds me in a way, the tension of that scene reminds, not in the same sort of way. I didn't have a sense of sort of growing dread like I did, but like I always compare it to the Mike Leigh film. What is it?
Which one?
The one with the girl who takes the
Happy-go-lucky.
Happy-go-lucky. It doesn't have that same kind of tension, but that
the scene, tension that she has with the lunatic.
It doesn't have that sort instructor. Of like growing dread like that movie does, but it does. The tension of that moment, the awkwardness of that moment, is there's something similar about that. You know, the sort of yeah.
That just reminded me that one of the scariest scenes in Happy-Go-Lucky for me is when she is who she is and she goes in, like, clueless and exuberant into that, like, homeless area or something
yeah,
like
that. Yeah, she's talking to a homeless guy and it's, like, abandoned, like, work site or something like that.
And it's not somewhere she should be alone.
Yeah.
It just feels, there's definitely a sense of dread.
Yeah.
But it's all a game because nothing really happens there. As far as I can recall. Anyway, that's a different film.
Well, I mean, this whole situation, like, so if just a little insight into me as a person, like, I would never, never do this. I would never go on a trip where it's me and some person that I kind of haven't really spent much time with in years, and we have to, like, be alone together in a car. That would be, like, the worst thing for me. Like, it would be so much awkward that I just couldn't even handle it. So I'm like, why did he even agree to do this? You know, I don't understand.
Because he knows if his wife is having the baby in 2 months, this is the last time he will ever do this.
Yeah, yeah.
He will never again be able to get a call and be able to drop everything and go away on a moment's notice on a camping trip with a friend. And so Mark is... there's this glimmer of, like, freedom and a last chance kind of thing to it.
Yeah.
That's why I said it's kind of like the bachelor party or something. Like, it's that kind of, like, I think
that's he's interesting.
He's about to enter a life where he can't ever do that again.
Yeah. Which...
because other people depend on him.
I forget about that because, I mean, my life isn't quite that way, but, like, really... it kind of is. Like, I could get a call tomorrow and go see my mom. You know, I wouldn't. But you don't have that freedom. And it's funny, because we're married.
If you're listening, you should call and,
you know. I may always have that freedom because of choices that I've made. But, like, you, I mean, like, there's always Wednesday and Thursday. You know, there's always... you know, a time when somebody's gonna need you to physically be there in it, you know, not just available, but actually physically there, which is different, you know.
He is a parent. He is a husband.
Yeah.
They're about to have a baby. He is not going to go on a camping trip.
No.
Like, he's kind of in trouble for going on this one.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, as close as she was, I mean, like, she could have gone into labor or something like that, you know, so.
So, this movie is now about 15 years old. It's about the most minimalist indie narrative
that I've ever seen. Yeah.
Is it possible to, is this a lost art form? I mean, is this kind of a film, like... can you see a film like this being made even now, today, just 15 years later? Like,
well, it couldn't have been too expensive to make.
No, but I mean, is there an audience for this anymore? Is there, does, can people relate to something like this?
Well, I mean...
is anybody speaking in this language anymore, this cinematic language?
Yes. I mean, the thing about indie film is, like, we're talking about, like, when you talk about, like, movies, it's like this big tent. It's a smaller tent than you would think, but it's still a big tent. And then, like, if you go to the indie side of the encampment, the indie tent is so much smaller, but we're talking about, like, niche audiences that like specific people, I mean, specific things. So so we can, there is room, but they just, it goes in the indie tent. It doesn't go in the big, I mean, it's under the big movie tent, but it goes in the little indie tent, and there will always be people going to the little indie tent.
The filmmaker of a movie like this is going to have to fund this themselves, because no one's going to greenlight a movie in which nothing happens.
Well, I mean, but the thing is you kind of piece together your funding, which is, you know, the joke that I like to make, which is I count the production companies at the start of independent films. I think 7 is the limit that I've seen so far. 7 different titled production companies involved. You can also count in
number of executive producers, because those are people who've paid money to have their names in.
But, you know, I mean, film was always expensive. I think that digital cameras are making it cheaper for people to do things. And people are going to find a way. You know, they may not make any money off of it. They might not be able to do it for work. You know, they might have to. But I think that there will be always be people telling small, intricate stories. You know, whether it's with their cell phone camera or, you know, with some rental equipment, or, you know, they're making it for their film class, or I don't know. I hope so. I don't think that it's going to go away. I mean, like, these, I think, are even less threatened than, like, the big movies are by the pandemic, because, like, you know, most people aren't going to see Old Joy in a theater anyway. They'll see it at home, you know, on their TV, or, you know, maybe a few of them saw it at a film festival or something like that. But I don't know. And I feel like even after this pandemic, I think that there might be sort of like a blossoming of like small stuff, you know, in the wake of this, and like, because people are feeling things and learning things about themselves. And I just think that that's going to come out in all sorts of art, including film. And so I think there is a place for it. It's just not a very big place, but it never would be. I mean, it's like, you know, there's people who go to museums and there's people who go to amusement parks, and sometimes there's some crossover between, but there's far more people who just want to go to amusement parks than want to go to museums. You know, it's just how it is, you know. But that doesn't make museums go away.
It's just fascinating because it's so rare to see a movie like this that slows down enough to be able to observe people like this in an ordinary moment, you know, where the major plot point, if you want to call it that, is a back rub or getting mildly turned around and having to camp at a sofa.
Yeah.
I mean, these are the big events of this movie, but it's, I don't know, there's something, I don't know if it's universal, but there's something that I connect with this. It works because it's about friends growing apart, and it works because it's about different life paths, and you from one side of the highway looking at what the other guy's doing and vice versa. And I think that's probably some of the stuff that I relate to in it. It's interesting because I probably was more like Mark with young children, toddlers or something, you know, like just starting that life the first time I saw this. And now here I am, my kids are teenagers and almost one of them almost on their way to college. And I still connect with this movie. I'm glad we watched it. I needed calm and quiet and meditative, and I don't know. I hope it wasn't boring.
You know, one thing that I'm thinking about, because I was trying to date the, because I had not read about it. I didn't know what we were watching until you put it in the DVD player, so it's not like I could do any pre-search or anything. But, like, I was trying to date the movie in time, and, like, during certain parts of the film, Mark is listening to the radio in his old Volkswagen, not Volkswagen, sorry.
Yeah, I was listening Volvo, to political talk radio.
Interesting, that Volvo is the same. My dad had an old square Volvo like that. He actually had two of them. One of them, he tried to fix the front of it, and he used some sand. He sanded it, and then the top of it all got all rusted because he didn't fit. Anyway, and then he had a second one, which my brother broke because he broke the timing chain on it. But anyway, two different okay. Volvo station wagons. But he's listening to, which I think it's Air America Radio based on the credits, but political radio station. And, like, I was trying to figure out the time period based on what they were talking about. But, like, Kelly or whoever chose the sound clips for it did a really good job of sort of picking these very, like, generic discussions that didn't mention, like, specific politicians or anything.
I heard Karl Rove mentioned.
Yeah. And I think if it was 2006, then it would have been the last couple years of George W. Bush's presidency. So... But, like, it's actually was, like, I was really tense about anything political because it's just been so fraught. I mean, like, if you're listening from outside the United States, it's been really fraught here for a very long time. And it was kind of relaxing to go back to this sort of more relaxing, generic sort of back and forth between Republican and Democrat, like, the basic values of the two parties that it used to be, where it was, like... You know, taxes and moral issues. And
you mean
not,
from the fragments we're hearing on the radio
station? Yeah, yeah. It was actually, I was a little nervous about hearing about what they were going to say.
There's actual discourse and different ideas being discussed here.
Well, and as I remember, Air America was sort of a more, like, discussy kind of, you know, discussing different aspects of it because it didn't seem to be leaning in one direction or the other. It was just kind of like discussing what Democrats were doing and what were, anyway. So it was actually kind of nice to harken back to that somewhat less fraught time.
Because,
although,
and I was thinking,
it didn't seem as not fraught at the time, but now it does, you know? So.
And I was thinking, like, what is this choice to have Mark listening to the political radio thing, and there's so little to analyze in this movie that I was like, is this some kind of weird parable or something, or about politics, you know, why are we hearing these particular fragments on the radio of discussion? It's just what he listens to.
Yeah, it's he just listens to talk radio on the drives, which, like, I understand. I mean, I used to listen to NPR all the time. I haven't been able to in 4 years, but
I don't know if I'm making this up, but I thought maybe Mark said something that made it sound like maybe he was a teacher or an educator of some kind, but I don't know if I'm just filling that in.
Yeah, I don't remember what they said that Mark did for a living or anything like that, but...
So we can't get you to watch Wendy and Lucy sometime? Maybe I should preview it.
I don't know. There's certain things that I'm really... Like, any sort of... I mean, like, I always talk about there's this one episode of Futurama, which I don't even know if I can talk about without crying, but Fry had a dog back in the 20th century or whatever, and then when he gets frozen, he gets sent in the future. Well, he has the opportunity to revive the dog, clone it or whatever, and bring it back so that he can spend time with it. And ultimately he decides not to do that because the dog probably lived a happy life. And then the last, like, minute of this episode is this montage of the dog, like, waiting for him at the pizza parlor every day. And, like, I can't watch it. It breaks me. But, like, I'm not functional. I can't deal with any sort of dog loss thing. It's just...
Okay.
You know, just the absolute, like, yeah.
Well,
I can talk about personal stuff about things that have happened with dogs in my life, but it just, it's for one of those, it just makes me too sad.
Well, we can skip that one and catch up with some of Kelly Reichardt's other movies, because I know we haven't seen the last few. The last two or three.
Yeah, yeah, I haven't. I mean, not that Meek's Cut Off was all that happy of a film either. So.
Well, she doesn't generally make happy films. No,
well, you know.
But she does make this quieter kind of movie most of the time.
Yeah, there's a lot of stillness. Not
usually as quiet as this. Wendy and Lucy is pretty quiet too, from what I saw.
She likes some. I think she probably has a little bit of influence from Mr. Malick. No, not Malick. Is that who I mean?
I don't know. Terrence Malick does make quiet films also.
Is the one, the Daniel Day-Lewis film that we saw for the...
Daniel Day-Lewis.
No.
It's... Oh, P.T. Anderson?
No.
What are you talking about?
We watched a film for the podcast that was set in Texas and...
That was Terrence Malick. Days of Heaven?
Terrence Malick, that's what I meant.
Daniel Day-Lewis isn't in it though.
Yes.
It's Richard Gere.
That's right.
And Sam Shepard.
Sam Shepard is the one who I was thinking was Daniel Day-Lewis. Anyway.
So that's where we went this week.
Yeah.
Do you have any other final thoughts?
I don't think so. I always am interested in films that are so quiet and so understated that, I mean, like, it takes talented actors. Actually, maybe it does. It takes people that are good at seeming natural. You know, that are able to, I don't know, but I'm always curious to see more films that are this way, this sort of, you know, the story isn't hyped up. It's not,
you know. Yeah, it's like, you know, what is the story? It challenges you to think about what story is.
I realize that short story writing has, like, you can have a short story where something crazy happens. And there's a lot of short stories that are like that. And a lot of those get made into films. But there's an equal amount, I think, of short stories where, like,
someone's just doing dishes and thinking about something. Yeah,
I mean, like, it's essentially, like, everything that happens in the story is interior. So, like, to make that into a film is, like, really, you know...
Why would you do that?
I like that. I like it. I'm curious to see that, you know, whether... And I think, you know, in this case, having not read... Sometimes... You know, you watch a film that has that in, and you've read the short story and, like, you're waiting for those beats so you can sort of guess at it. But in this case, like, I came at it with nothing. So, like, it was cool to sort of guess at what these people might be feeling. And
you're really just kind of along for the ride.
Yeah.
It's like we got to go on the road trip.
Yeah, that's true.
We got to go on a mediocre road trip.
I don't think it was mediocre. It was a bad, for me, it was a bad road trip. Oregon's pretty.
It did not look fun when they woke up the next morning and had to put on their boots and after staying at this terrible sofa area.
Lucy seemed like she had a good time though.
Lucy had a great trip. See, Lucy's just an actress. Nothing bad really happens to Lucy.
Lucy's a good dog.
All right, well, it's your turn again next time.
Yes.
No pressure about choosing the right movie for our times like I always put on myself.
Oh, okay.
It's weird because it's like, I'm trying to like match our mood because it's like something we're going to do with our evening or our afternoon, but also like, what do I want to put out there for our listeners to hear and deal with too?
That's true.
So this is a great, quiet little movie that I think is rewarding if you give it some time. It is minimalist, it's a little bit slow, but it's quite, I don't know, beautiful and perceptive, and there's stuff to identify with, and maybe sometimes we need to go back to 2006 before smartphones and just ride in a car and hang out with an old friend. So
let's just get rid of all our cell phones. It probably would be better for everyone involved, just get rid of them. You know, for our non-US listeners that are wondering, because I know that people are wondering, we're not okay. No one is okay right now. So it's good to to be quiet and still and away from the terribleness sometimes. So, yeah.
Well, Biden gets inaugurated on Wednesday.
Yes. I'm not entirely convinced that's going to fix everything, but it's a start.
All right. We leave you with some thoughts about the state of the United States and indie film.
Yes.
The career of Kelly Reichardt and a great quiet movie called Old Joy. And we'll catch up with you again in a couple weeks when it'll be Ashley's turn to pick the movie.
Yes.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again next time. Bye.